Just so, the other thing that such romances seem to supply is air itself, which is to say that, in them, the air is always in our face. It presses itself upon us as a thing described, so we know it to be chilly, damp, tinted, stale, putrid, occasionally but ever only temporarily pure. And Gothic air stands out as a medium for other things, voices, sighs, groans, lightning, music, apparitions. Gothic air is an interfering vehicle for information, in a word, even as it is literature's superficial forms that loudly inform us that it is. These two helixes, the lexical and the aerial, define and perpetuate early Gothic writing, though often to nerve-wracking effect, since the information that both helixes carry is usually so inscrutable. But nowhere does trepidation about what writing might hold, mean, convey coincide more often with trepidation about what the air might hold, mean, or convey than in Anne Radcliffe's ubiquitous romances of the 1790s. The heftiest and most ubiquitous of these, The Mysteries of Udolpho, opens with a glimpse of the majestic Pyrenees, whose summits, veiled in clouds or exhibiting awful forms, were seen and lost again as the partial vapors rolled along and gleamed through the blue tinge of air. Some 400 pages later, the inexplicably named Italian castle of the title rises, silent, lonely, and sublime. Its moldering stones seem to sigh as the breeze rolled past. Udolpho's reluctant guest, the aptly surnamed Emily St. Aubert, is the daughter of a botanist who, back in the cradle of that blue Pyrenean air, once valiantly tried to teach her the habit of cool examination. But because her Gothic environment is so clammy, so cool itself, this amounts to just the opposite of analytic detachment. So does Emily, on approach, anxiously survey Udolpho's edifice, managing to distinguish little more than part of its outline, and uncertain whether she is yet outside or inside it, unable, really, to tell herself apart from it. That is because Udolpho is conspicuously of a piece with the book that Emily is, after all, in, one where air, as in the very word Udolpho, appears to be trapped inside the letters that convey it. So, when Emily opens a window to inspire the pure air, she is met not with the breeze, but with, quote, sweet and picturesque sounds, if such an expression may be allowed. She is, in other words, met with the medium of literary expression at its most obtrusive. Or is it intrusive? Either way, Emily sets out with her ailing father in search of, what else, better air, and Radcliffe borrows a line from James Thomson's Spring to render the serene air by breezy murmurs cool that she breathes. When Emily looks out into volumes of mist, it's hard to imagine we might be anywhere but inside of a pun. Encounters with the air in The Mysteries of Udolpho are never even ostensibly direct experiences. They're hyper-mediated reminders that we are in a book, which is to say, in a contrived system of mediating signs, one that, as such, oppresses every bit as much as it protects from whatever really is out there. Give me air, gasps Emily in the bowels of Udolpho, where she can entertain no doubt but that a violent change in the air has just effected a fatal one on the exhausted frame of the aunt who'd been her only protector. Emily herself is always breathless from fear or the want of fresh air, if not from some loquacious servant having sucked all of it out of the room. Her spirits, as Radcliffe puts it, suffer extremely from want. Surely this is because, despite the blue tinge of air that Radcliffe always paints into her celebrated landscapes, despite the airs her cultured heroines play on lutes or compose in lines of verse, and despite the haughty airs that their oppressors inevitably assume, despite all this air, there really isn't any there at all apart from the word on the page. It's Radcliffe's genius to make it clear that it is to these typographical characters that our human ones are responding when they seem to breathe or sigh. Small wonder that her female characters should find such informing, indeed constitutive environments so oppressive. Radcliffe herself succumbed to spasmodic asthma in 1826, almost 30 years after she published her last novel, The Italian. Apparently, for all her popularity and influence, in the end, she too found this kind of thing less cool than just plain suffocating. Her two literary heirs automatically restrict the very experience that they make possible. Contemporary readers were quick to gauge both the apparent abundance of Radcliffean air and its strange, asphyxiating vacuity. They drew on Radcliffe's own aerial bent to conceptualize and reproduce in their own readers the kind of experience everyone presumably has reading her. Commenting on the novelist's celebrated vistas, for example, Walter Scott remarked that, quote, there is, as it were, a haze over her landscape, softening indeed the whole, but without conveying any absolutely precise or individual image to the reader. He threw in an example. The beautiful description of Udolpho as Emmeline approaches it is of this character. Scott may have gotten her name wrong, but he very properly has Emily approaching not a place referenced by Radcliffe's writing, but a beautiful description within it, one that, composed of the same typographical characters, can only disappear into the haze over her landscape, and thence into the critical texts, equally evanescent, as it were. As for Radcliffe's other signature, the so-called explained supernatural, a visibly irked Mary Wollstonecraft likened the novelist's quasi-scientific mode of accounting in a natural manner for unsupernatural appearances to the manufacture of, quote, glistening bubbles blown up in air, only to evaporate more conspicuously, leaving the aching sight searching after the splendid nothing. Thanks for nothing, Wollstonecraft seems to say. For both her and Scott, a sense of air as cheat, as in fact nothing, was bound up with the sense of air as mere and confining and literal stereotype. It's a problem that has always plagued Radcliffe's fiction. It was how Scott could mistake Emily for Charlotte Smith's Gothic heroine Emmeline, and why when Hazlitt thought of Radcliffe's heroes. Well, here it is. Theodore, Valancourt, what delightful names, and there was nothing else to distinguish them by. An American of her day likewise complained that Radcliffe's style is a constant ringing of bells and mists and glens and portcullises and moats, etc., etc. Even Radcliffe's most sympathetic English biographer admitted that her compulsive repetition of the same images of rock, wood, and water and the same epithets of grand, vast, and sublime must appear tautologous. The air that seems to permeate Radcliffe's romances is just a repeated word, too. It could be abstract, creep, it's all the same. What makes air different from other kinds of words isn't it that it's composed so pretentiously in and through the automatic combination and recombination of superficial and stereotypical forms. Not only does Radcliffe's air visibly dissolve into the letters that literally compose it, it's also transmitted through the lines of dead English poets that Radcliffe cites on every page. Milton, Thomson, Collins, Shakespeare, Gray, they're all there, or parts of them are, and while Radcliffe puts them to more than one use, it is remarkable how often she imports the renderings of air, English air, natural and supernatural alike. So Collins's aerial forms appear in Radcliffe's epigraphs to erase the line dividing the inside of a chapter from the outside, or Ossian's gale of spring wafts through her narration to erase the distinction between the air that blows in her books and that which blows outside them in those of others. If you knew that Ossian's bardic stylizations were actually forged by their 18th century translator, you'll truly see what I'm getting at here, thin air. Virginia Woolf once said that Gothic fiction is more involved with the ordinary. There's this my little boy. Okay. Let's see. Virginia Woolf once said that Gothic fiction is far more involved with the ordinary English library than with anything to be found outside it. Following her lead, Deirdre Lynch has read Radcliffe's citations from the ordinary library as vexatious ghosts of an Anglophone literary canon. But even as they reveal the presence of a then-consolidating system of English literary practices and values, reviving gales, like those Radcliffe stole from Thomson, are also legible as what we call feedback loops. Here, Radcliffe's own literary composition analytically decomposes that system from inside. Her borrowed airs are nodes that, though they exist entirely in and of that system, can nonetheless bicker with its laws of property and propriety. If you've read Radcliffe, you know that at the level of her own Byzantine plots, similar laws constrain her floating, elastic, blue-eyed, her aeriform heroines, to whom properties like Udolpho do and do not belong. Meanwhile, Radcliffe's tendency to register the aerial forms of her literary forebears in ghostly italics presses back upon the print medium to underscore the finally spectral character of literary property. These same forms can make Radcliffe's fiction feel less like a story than a syllabus. That's not to devalue them, though. Syllabus happens to have been one form in which real English air was conceived and displayed in Radcliffe's day. Consider the demographer Thomas Short's 1767 Short Syllabus of the Air, Weather, and Seasons. While Radcliffe's air might look canned, stylized, a composition of recombinant typefaces and depleted literary forms, it was still also consistent with the manner in which her English speaking and writing contemporaries engaged the air about them, scientifically and philosophically. Short's own syllabus was partly a pastiche of the writings of, quote, many ingenious gentlemen in different and distant places who had kept journals of the weather and its temperatures. The proliferation of works, just like Short's short syllabus, throughout the 18th century suggests a hitherto unappreciated analytic potential in the explicitly literary mediation of the medium of air. And I venture, the then-present state of English atmospheric studies entitled both Radcliffe and her female